Good afternoon. My name is Joseph Coleman, registration number 68256, appearing on behalf of St. Sophia Partners. And at council table with me is the partner of St. Sophia Partners. You have endured 190 pages of briefs so far, and 15 minutes is not the time for me to try to summarize what I thought was relevant on those, my share of those pages. But I do believe that it would be helpful if we address some easy points, and that is, in their final reply, there are a number of issues that I don't believe were ever raised before. And I at least want to make a very quick note of it. They're stating that various town agreements, which were central and argued in the district court, they contend were never an issue. Factually, they're wrong, but more germane, it wasn't raised until the reply brief. Second, they talk about if the town agreements have some relevance, should the town have been joined? Again, no indispensable party issue was raised, no issue was mentioned until the final reply brief about the town needing to be a party. They also talk about an unreasonable restraint on alienation. That was briefly mentioned in their answer opening brief, but it was not raised in the trial court. The issue that somehow St. Sophia...
Well, let me stop you there if I could, please.
Excuse me?
To go back to your point on an unreasonable restraint, we're reviewing the covenant de novo. Don't we have to consider whether it's a reasonable restraint on alienation?
I think particularly under the restatement of properties third, you are correct. And so if the court addresses it from that perspective, there's no question that public policy is one of the considerations.
Okay.
I don't think I disagree, but I can't tell you that I can think of a case that on the touch and concern common law, that restraint of alienation was actually mentioned. But it would be very appropriate under the restatement.
Thank you.
Then they also state an issue that only St. Sophia should be required to build the parking, and that issue was never raised in any briefs prior to the reply, and clearly not in the trial court. Then they conclude with saying, we've got some unspecified other issues of fact. Well, I think merely the title itself shows that it's unspecified, it's clearly not supported by anything in the record, and again, it was raised for the first time. Now, with respect to the transaction, the legal arguments have been briefed extensively, but sometimes you lose focus of what the case is really about by tunnel vision. This case starts with Mr. Steve Cram, who was the St. Sophia incorporator, spending 20 years assembling a variety of properties in the town of Mountain Village. Ultimately, he achieved the goal of acquiring property that had approved density and property that was appropriate for the necessary parking. But there were different properties. Adjacent but different. So they were hand in glove if anything was going to be done in accordance with the town rules so that the property could actually be put to a beneficial use.
Well, now are you talking about the ridge lots at the top of the gondola as opposed to the base area?
Correct. He accumulated the ridge lots and then accumulated lot 161, which sometimes referred to as the core property or property. Both were essential. And the town recognized that. That's why the town had the two town agreements and said, we're not going to allow that density up on the top of the mountain unless you show us where they're going to park their cars. The town of Mountain Village, as you may know, is a unique community. They rely heavily on the gondola for transportation, and they severely restrict automobiles. And therefore, you will find parking for them, and you will not park on the streets. So the town ultimately approved the development of the ridge lots, expressly contingent upon lot 161 being deed restricted, that it absolutely had to have parking for the ridge lots. This was done before the Monument Realty, or what we call MR, or MR181, even arrived on the scene. However, a buyer did arrive. Monument Realty, developer large developer out of Washington, D.C. decided to defund the building Telluride. And they're ace in the hole, so that people would talk to them and said, we come with Lehman Brothers. They're our lender. They've lent hundreds of millions of dollars to us. So Lehman Brothers, from the very start, was part of the negotiations. That explains why the subordination agreement was negotiated and signed directly by Lehman Brothers and cross-references the covenant that we're discussing. Lehman Brothers had extensive input. And Lehman Brothers may be big, but if they wanted to buy this property, they had to ironclad guarantee the parking. Because without that ironclad guarantee, innocent rich lot owners would have unmarketable property because they would have the no parking that the town required, therefore they couldn't get building permits. The town would be incensed because they had a general zoning plan for the area that would have been rendered meaningless. Because without the parking, they didn't want the density.
Well, as I read the town agreements, no one was required to build any, to create any parking. It was simply a condition of further development. So under the town agreements, the core property could have sat there vacant forever.
Well, that is correct when it was originally executed. But when the town issued the permits to allow building on the ridge lots, they actually allowed the subdivision to start once we had the covenants. Because with the covenants, that was what they considered the adequate deed restriction. And the town is now comfortable that it's going to happen. Nobody can now acquire this property without seeing that if you acquire it, you're bound to build. And so you're correct at the initial stage, but ultimately there was construction. Now it's been limited because the town has thrown up its hand saying, we don't know what to do now because it's so delayed. And so it's been a real problem. But the main point is Lehman is not a traditional lender that you go to the bank and the bank lends on a mortgage. Lehman is an investment banker. They came in with a 20%, I believe, profit interest, and a right to acquire a joint interest in the joint venture. I mean, they were the substance behind MR. MR 181 was a shell. All it owned was the property. It had no other assets. Therefore, getting a promise from them is somewhat worthless. Getting the promise and the obligation that the property was bound was critical. Now, with that said, as I said, Steve Graham had spent 20 years assembling this property, and he personally was involved in the negotiations with Lehman over the subordination agreement, where Lehman said, we don't want to be restricted this way or that way. He said, well, you're not going to buy it unless you give us these assurances. So they did. This whole case boils down to the fact that the briefs by defendant clearly state that MR is bound to build. MR is contractually obligated. But they have never once in the trial court or in any of their briefs explained how paragraph 1, which says core owner, which was MR, and its successors and assigns, and anyone who requires an interest in the property, is bound.
That assumes that the covenant survives the test of an unreasonable restraint on alienation and will bind the successors.
That's correct. Okay. The alienation issue is a public policy, and I agree, no contract is enforced if it's against public policy. Insofar as the successor and assigned, I think it was written exactly like all covenants in the world. Yeah. And, you know, when you buy a condo, you're personally bound. You don't go sign an assumption agreement. Where the trial court went wrong is the trial court found that the covenant ran with the property. Inferentially, she found that the town agreements ran with the property. But she then said, I want the remedies, not the promise, not the obligation of performance to run with the property. I want the remedy also to run with the property. Well, if that were the law in Colorado, no condominium or common ownership could collect interest for delayed performance. They couldn't collect attorney fees, because the attorney doesn't go out and turn a shovel of dirt to earn his fees. He doesn't improve the property. He enforces the covenant. It's the remedy. The liquidated damages is nothing more sophisticated than the statutory interest. It's really a form of liquidated damages. The legislature has said prejudgment interest is liquidated at 8% if you haven't agreed to something else. What we have done is one step further. We have just stated there's a dollar amount that's liquidated. I'll reserve my 4.5 minutes and thank you for your attention.
Good afternoon. If it may please the court, my name is Hillary Wells. My registration number is 33952, and I represent the appellee and cross appellant in this matter, CO Lot 161. At issue here are two core documents, but I think the relationship with the party or between the parties or the absence of a relationship is worth exploring at the beginning in response to some of the questions that Your Honor, Judge Webb raised. Colorado Lot 161 exists only because MR 181 defaulted on a $15 million loan to Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers is not a party to the parking covenant. Nowhere in that covenant did Lehman Brothers provide that it would guarantee any of the obligations of MR under the parking covenant. What the parking agreement provides at Section 17 is certain protection for Lehman Brothers. It says that Lehman Brothers, as the lender, had the right, but not the obligation, to cure any default by MR under the parking covenant. And that is truly critical here, because what the plaintiff, what Saint Sophia has argued, even as recently as just a moment ago, is that Lehman Brothers somehow came into this deal guaranteeing MR's performance. And respectfully, we submit that the documents don't support that assertion. Instead, the documents support the assertions that have been made here, which is Colorado Lot 161, as the entity formed by Lehman Brothers for the sole purpose of taking title to the property because it had to foreclose on its senior deed of trust, that entity, like Lehman Brothers, offered no guarantee, and it is not a successor to either MR or St. Sophia. The successor provision that the plaintiff is referring to is found in section 9.13 of the agreement. It's not a successor's provision that I've seen in our usual homeowner's covenant type situation where it's successor's entitled. If I sell my house in Highlands Ranch, then somebody else who purchases my house in Highlands Ranch is likewise subject to the declarations and covenants of the homeowners association. Rather, what that provision provides is that, again, I'm quoting, the terms and provisions of this covenant are binding upon and inure to the benefit of the transferees, successors, devisees, and assigns of the parties hereto. The parties to that agreement are MR, who's defined in the first paragraph of that agreement as a core owner, and St. Sophia. And so I think that, as I said, understanding who is here and who is not is important. Lehman didn't guarantee MR's obligations, and CO Lot 161, as the entity formed to take the title to the property as a result of Lehman's foreclosure, likewise did not take subject to these obligations.
Well, why isn't Lehman as the foreclosing creditor and CO Lot 161 as its successor, a transferee of MR, from a title perspective? I mean, the difference is, it's an involuntary transfer, but I mean, would you be making that argument if MR had simply sold its interest in the property to Lehman, and Lehman in turn sold its interest to CO Lot 161?
It would depend on the terms of the sale. If MR sold its obligations to Lehman to perform under the agreement, and the parking covenant did provide that St. Sophia and MR had the right to form other entities to assume their obligations, and that if they did those, did so, those created entities would then be responsible. So to answer your question, if somebody had purchased MR's obligation or its right to develop, that's really what it was. MR paid $9.5 million to purchase the lot. $8 million was cash, $1.5 million was a promissory note. But what it had was a right to develop on that property, and the parking covenant reflected that. Had a willing buyer come in and MR sold all of its bundle of rights to develop and the title on that property, we would be having a very different argument, because I do believe then that entity who agreed to assume MR's rights and to assume its obligations would then be a successor under this agreement. But a successor in title alone, I submit, is not what this paragraph contemplates. It doesn't, it just seems to me to be impossible to suggest that merely by having title, somebody else would have assumed obligations to build or commence construction on a large development, including a parking structure, by no later than June 1, 2007, and complete construction by no later than 2009. The facts of this case are that the commencement and completion deadlines expired 6 months before title was vested in CO Law 161 by reason of Lehman Brothers' foreclosure on its senior deed of trust. I'd also like to speak
to counsel, if I may. I read your argument as a suggestion that the result, if we rule the way that St. Sophia wants us to rule, that's going to discourage lenders from getting involved in these sorts of projects.
That certainly is part of the argument.
Could you explain that to me, please?
Absolutely. The lender in this situation wasn't even a construction lender. As we pointed out in our briefs, MR contemplated a project that would have cost hundreds of millions of dollars to finance. Lehman Brothers, for its part, agreed to make a $14.385 million loan. It provided in the parking covenant the protection it needed to make sure it didn't become the guarantor of its customer's very ambitious development plan. If this court were to conclude that parties to a development plan can look to one or the other's lender to guarantee that obligation, we do respectfully submit that that would absolutely chill the market for lending. Money was lent because Lehman was willing to part with it in exchange for the terms of repayment. Nothing in that agreement suggested that Lehman was going to be willing to step into MR's shoes and perform obligations that MR itself had not performed within the specific timelines provided in this covenant. So does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Ms. Wolf, I just want to follow up on that a little bit. Doesn't your argument in some respects follow a contract theory? What if we look at the covenant running with the land? Then do the timelines become important if we were to find it as a covenant running with the land?
If I understand the question, yes, the arguments we've raised first are contract issues. Who by the plain language of the agreements is obligated to specifically perform? And when do those specific performance rights or obligations expire? That's the argument with respect to St. Sophia that has the right to specific performance against MR to complete within the construction timeline. So that's the plain language argument. As far as running with the land, I don't know that it makes a difference that the timelines are. As far as running with the land, the timelines are important because when the document is recorded, it gives notice to CO Lot 161 or whoever else may later come in the chain of title that at one point in time, MR was obligated to commence construction, and that that point in time ended by no later than June 1, 2009. So I'm not sure that touching and concerning the land really affects the date deadlines, but what I would submit is that with all due respect, it would be inappropriate to in some rewrite the deal to provide some different construction timeline. And on a related note, I would point out that this is a 38-page document that contemplates many, many other agreements. MR did, as it was required to do, submit the core sketch plans to the town in May of 2006. There were no architectural plans for this parking structure that are reflected in this covenant. It doesn't even identify where on this 3-acre lot the parking structure would go. The only guidance given at all is perhaps that it's by reason of the deed restriction. If the property is developed with parking, it's going to be underground parking. And I wanted to speak to that deed restriction just briefly. The deed restriction provided St. Sophia options with respect to how to fulfill its obligations to ensure that the homes on the ridge top had parking. There could either be a parking structure on lot 161 that afforded the necessary parking, or St. Sophia could pay into the town parking fund, or both. And I think the restriction itself is interesting because it's not a height restriction, it's not a density restriction. It's a record against this property that if there's development, that there'll either need to be parking here or St. Sophia is going to need to pay into a parking fund.
If you read the town agreement in the context of the cross-reference design regulation, does that state the amount that St. Sophia would have to pay to be relieved of the deed restriction?
My recollection is that the deed restriction provides that St. Sophia would need to pay into the parking fund the amount currently being collected by the town on a per space basis, and that was the basis for the $26,000 cost for each of the spaces that was to be conveyed by MR via warranty deed.
Okay.
With respect to the subordination and standstill agreement, because that is the only agreement that Lehman's a party to, I point out several things. One, it says that the reason it was entered into was in order to induce Lehman to make a loan of more than $14 million. St. Sophia agreed in connection with that agreement that it would subordinate a deed of trust that it had by reason of the $1.5 million promissory note given at the time of purchase in 2005. And it agreed in section 6 that if there was a default under the Lehman Brothers loan, that Lehman Brothers would be paid first and paid in full before St. Sophia would receive anything on its promissory note. I point this out because it seems to me a bit of a tortured exercise to try to find that the subordination agreement, the agreement to get Lehman to lend millions of dollars, somehow created rights that didn't already exist, and that's been the argument here. The argument is that CLOT 161 or the land should have to pay damages because MR didn't perform. On its terms, that agreement contemplated that MR's loss, if any, would be the loan, and that St. Sophia may not be paid at all if there was a default on that loan. The agreement also provides that the rights of St. Sophia are preserved, and the word preservation is important. In September 2005, St. Sophia still had rights. There were rights to possible pre-construction parking. There were rights to parking during construction. There was the right to have the warranty deeds conveyed on 20 spaces to be included in the parking structure built by MR by June 1, 2009. By the time of foreclosure in December 2009, all of those rights had expired and nothing had vested. There'd been no transfer of deeds. There was no parking structure within which someone could transfer deeds for parking spaces. And so while the document did preserve the rights that would exist at the time of foreclosure, it didn't create new rights. And it didn't represent Lehman's assumption of any obligation of MR. Again, what it assured is that if and when Lehman had to exercise its right to foreclose on the senior deed of trust, whatever rights St. Sophia had at the time of foreclosure, and now we're talking 4.5 years later, or 4 years, 3 months, those rights, if they existed, would be preserved. But nothing about it suggests that the rights, that there would be rights vested, or that Lehman Brothers would agree to step in for MR to ensure those rights.
Well, is there any, are you relying on any language in paragraph 4 of the subordination agreement to suggest that if Sophia's rights under the parking covenant, which is the operative phrase, would be measured as of the date of the foreclosure rather than as of the date of this document?
I'm relying on not the section 4 is the section, Your Honor is correct, where the subordination provision or where the preservation language appears. But with respect to the foreclosure date, there's no way that this document, with all due respect, could have included what would happen on a future date because nobody knew, everybody hoped this would be a good deal. nobody expected MR to default on its loan, or the loan wouldn't have been made in the first place. And so you're right, the document doesn't say the rights that exist at the time of foreclosure, but it does say preserved. And we respectfully submit that that means that at the time of foreclosure, there has to be rights to preserve, that it doesn't create rights that aren't otherwise there.
Thank you.
Now, on our cross appeal, we've asked the court to review under a de novo standard the order providing the plaintiff with the right to build on my client's property. Respectfully, we find nothing in the agreement that affords St. Sophia a right to come on the land and build some unspecified structure on some unspecified location with no approval from the town. We reviewed the document. There's just no post June 1, 2009 right to come on this property and build. The second issue we raised is the credit with respect to the same provision Your Honor just raised in Section 4, the subordination and standstill agreement. We respectfully submit that as a practical matter, it's a nullity. Because at the time of foreclosure, there wasn't a structure within which Lehman could have conveyed spaces to St. Sophia, and Sophia couldn't purchase spaces in that structure from Lehman. If somebody later builds a parking structure on this property, Lehman will have no ability to give a credit in somebody else's structure. And as I said, the financial obligations between the parties are already set in Section 6 of the subordination agreement, and I'm very comfortable representing my client, Lehman Brothers, though, has not been paid anywhere near in full on this defaulted loan. I see my time is running out. I thank you very much for your time this afternoon.
To address some of the issues just mentioned, the subordination agreement doesn't talk, as she suggests, that it only applies to transfers of fee ownership. Excuse me, not the subordination agreement, paragraph one, where it says client successors and assigned, which is we weren't a buyer, wasn't in the dialogue. It talks about transfers of the property or any interest therein, or any right therein. Clearly the deed of trust that was granted by owner to Lehman was a transfer of an interest, and that interest then ultimately was transferred to the current subsidiary of Lehman. The claim of paragraph 17 about the holder of the first deed of trust, there is no first deed of trust that defendant has ever owned. Defendant was an assignee after the foreclosure was commenced, after the deed of trust had already been tendered to the public trustee, and defendant is an owner. And as owner, he doesn't have the option to pretend that he still has the first deed of trust.
Pardon me for interrupting, if I may, Mr. Coleman. I'd like to please ask a question about, this may be more of a policy question, but help me with this impression that I have of your argument and convince me why this is not so. Basically, I see your argument as suggesting that not only do these responsibilities run with the land, but MR's default runs with the land, and thus Colot, as a successor, is burdened with the default of MR and thus has to step into MR's shoes. And this concerns me because there's no indication in what we have that Colot bargained for an obligation to build the garage, signed on the contract, or later on expressly said, we assume this obligation. So can you help me with
yes.
that, please?
The simple analysis is the secondary or second mortgages. Second mortgage can come in and be a $10,000 on a home or a $10 million on a building. If there's a $100 million first on it, without a doubt, they're going to have to pay that if they want the property. There's nothing signed which says we hereby assume the first lien. And that's all we have here. We have someone coming in who got a bargain because Colorado case law recognizes that covenants are taken into account when you negotiate the price. So MR was able to negotiate a discounted price because it had a future obligation to pay. That future obligation is analogous to a first mortgage or a first encumbrance. And so there's nothing, if you have a policy that second mortgages can wipe out first mortgages, yes, you will destroy lending in this state. And that's what they're trying to do. They have created a situation where they negotiated and said, sat across the table and said, your parking will be built. Our subordination agreement will state that even if we foreclose, your parking will be built because the covenant survives. Then they come in and say, we're big enough, you can't afford to fight us. And so they put this small organization through years of fighting, arguing that we don't have to perform what we promised you. And that's what gets my client. They're no different than any other junior lien holder. They want free, clear title, but they lent on encumbered title. The only other issues I would quickly mention is that replacement parking, that was what the simple solution was. Why Lena hasn't done it cannot be explained. The replacement parking, anytime they wanted to move it, when they found a buyer who wanted to put in a major project, they could move it. We just did an exchange or right through the replacement parking. But they refused to do anything. And that's the frustration. If they would have been told, you got liquidated damages, they had that replacement parking in 120 days. But the trial court gave no indication it was going to award any remedies. They said, yes, you're bound, but we're not going to award remedies. We're just asking that as soon as they're told that the liquidated damages is a remedy and it's analogous to a first lien and you lent in a subordinate position, you're going to have to now answer to the fact that you're a subordinate lender.
Your time's up, but I'd appreciate an answer to this question. Is there any provision in the parking covenant that expressly states the liquidated damages constitute a lien on the property?
I believe so, because it says repeatedly that all provisions of the covenant will bind and run with the land. Consequently, whether the provision is that you will build something, or whether it is that you will pay attorney fees if you're sued, or if it's because you have to pay delay damages because you didn't do it timely, all of those provisions fall within the terms of the covenant, and the subordination agreement specifically states, if we foreclose, the covenant survives.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your attention.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.